Well, hello everyone, and this is the fourth of the special interviews I'm doing this week. Yesterday I talked to Haz about China, which has proven to be a little bit controversial. I spoke to Caleb Maupin about how the modern left is basically fake and the CIA backed on Tuesday, and then on Monday I talked to Todd Lewis about why the dissident right failed as an intellectual project. Today, however, we're coming back from the world of theory right into the world, into the real world. And I've got my buddy Scrump on. How are you doing, yes. Scrump?
Yes, welcome to the real world.
The real world.
I'm doing pretty good, thank you. As good as I can be, but it's raining outside and the weather's closed in and I'm all stuffed up. I don't think I've got a cold, I just think it's miserable winter weather making us all schnuffly.
And before we get going, we joked off air that we're going to do a book off. Obviously, I've got Applied Elite Theory. buy it now. But you've got one.
Oh, you know, just,
he's got like, Anti-Politics.
Yeah. Well, you wrote the foreword for it. So
and I wrote the foreword for that. Yes, it's a good book. It actually
It
would look nice, you know, on the shelf with where's my lovely hardback Populist Illusion? But they've all got these. We just love the aesthetic of the old fashioned textbook,
it's
don't we?
Aesthetic.
We
that's,
get them yeah. all get them all together. build up the collection.
I didn't want to have like just like you know wig net skeleton like it should be painted on like, the side of a van like some people do.
Like, massive lightning.
Yeah, yeah, lightning and yeah, anti politics. Airbrush it now, yeah.
All right, so yeah, pick up all those books and courses, etc. But the reason I've asked John on is because it was a while back now, but I made a few tweets where I said I'd noticed that something weird is happening in the British economy. In fact, I'm in the process, or I have been in the process, of buying a bathroom, John, and it's taken...
As have I, actually.
Yeah, it's taken months and months and months because the missus is a fusspot, and there's this really posh tile company called Fired Earth, right? Fired Earth. Oh. I called it Fried Earth as a joke. And finally, she was like, okay, I found some tiles I like. We put a deposit down. It's going to happen. And then literally in the middle of it, like, so that was on the Friday. And then on the Monday, they were like, sorry, Fired Earth has just gone into administration. We've gone bust, basically. And the administrators have come in, thereby nixing my new bathroom, which is a real pain.
Have you lost your deposit and everything?
No, they're gonna give it back because you know the administrators are in, so they're honoring all their debts and so on. But the it led me to have a look. I was like, oh, that's a weird company. And then I noticed that that fashion store Claire's, you know, they're like the female, like women buy necklaces and stuff in there, Claire's.
Yeah, yeah, shop. I know.
I think that went under, and then I started to have a look, and I was like, in 2025, hundreds and hundreds of companies have suddenly gone under like this with no warning, right? So Fired Earth was, you know, trading normally, and then out of nowhere, went into administration, and this has happened in a number of different areas, and the biggest one reported on was actually construction. I was like, hold on a second. We're in the middle of like one of the biggest housing expansions since Clement Attlee, you know, under the Starmer government. They want to build all these new towns everywhere. How have we got hundreds and hundreds of construction companies going bust? And so the reason this kind of made me look up is because this struck me as something happening in the real economy, not in the financialized world of futures and markets and stocks and shenanigans. This is like real companies trading, just going under out of nowhere. And then I started to have a look and I was like, well, it seems like something's happening here under the surface. And Scrump said, well, I know what's happening. So over to you, Scrump. What is happening?
Well, I'll start generally, which is just a lot of the COVID stuff is running out. Really, if you've worked for a medium-sized company that has to pay the bills or you run a small business, you know what a boon to many people, or at least what a life support the COVID era was. it extended a lot further than people think as well. A lot of people were still getting COVID loans and payments and being weaned off them in 2022. If you look at America, America was even worse. There were still COVID loans going out in 2023 and 2024, if you looked at it. So there was this huge stimulus which created... The Austrians would talk about malinvestment, but really it's the... All, I think you talked about this on Twitter, but all the different economic theories come at the same problem from different angles. But it is the same problem in that instability messes everything up. You can't economically plan in an unstable environment. And that's really what we have here. We have an unstable environment. It's not just inflation. It's the consequence of inflation. It is the inability to plan economically. And it is really like economics 101. Construction specifically, I'll give you an example, though. A lot of firms are failing because there's so much work around. A lot of these companies are eating themselves to death, as I would think of it, in that they will be a medium-sized company that takes on a lot of work to try and turn themselves into a large company and attract a buyer. A lot of the problem is that firms these days, a lot of how you make your exit money if you're an investor is by selling the firm. So you are incentivized to get your turnover up. So if you're a construction company getting into one of these Sadiq Khan-funded construction projects in London, you might take on a lot of work in, say, 2019 and 2020, especially because lots of work was planned in 2020, and the delivery date on that will be delayed and delayed and delayed, and as it's being delayed, prices are going up and up and up and up. And you agreed to the contract here, and now the price of your raw materials is here. So what are you going to do? How are you going to deal with that? Either you renegotiate the contract, which takes a long time and in itself can be disadvantageous, or you just eat the losses and possibly go bust. A lot of these companies will just be doing some balance sheet calculations. They might have one or two large projects they're part of that have been delayed and delayed and delayed and renegotiated. And if these large contracts fall through, then the company's over. A lot of people are already over-leveraged, and it is just the effect of... Companies took on a lot of work in a very loose credit environment in the 2020s, early 2020s. It's now the mid-2020s. That loose credit environment is still there, but the actual product it hasn't been bought. The consumer confidence is incredibly low. Inter-business purchases are low. Everyone's struggling for money. And so it's just the result of a negative cycle and the fact that really people are, after the fake COVID era, on their last legs. This is really the bills coming in for most people. It is people paying for Christmas. And a lot of people don't go bust at Christmas. They go bust, you know, in February or March. And it's like that. It's the economy isn't, it doesn't move on normal terms. A business has a business environment it exists in for years. And it may eat up its capital without any outward signs of it being a dying business. And then it reaches a point of going, well, we're supposed to pay this person 20p. We can't find 20p in the couch cushions. I guess the business is over. Mm. It's that simple, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that so what you're saying is they sign a contract, inflation kicks in the interim. When they come to fulfill the contract, it's now no longer actually viable for the price they agreed at. Yes.
They've agreed to put up a building, and they're now paying to put up that building rather than being paid.
One of the things I was wondering about, because you know, obviously, I see a lot of right wing Twitter, a lot of hype, and a lot of criticism of the Starmer government. A lot of the talk from the finance bros has been that what Rachel Reeves and Starmer are doing is causing capital flight, almost like 1970s style capital flight. You know, they're putting up taxes, they're trying to balance the books, which means squeezing the rich, essentially. And one of the things I was wondering is, are any of these sudden closures that are happening at the moment anything to do with people just like running away from Labour?
It's a trigger situation where a lot of these are extremely fragile companies. They were going to fail at some point, and you could argue that Labour has made them failed, but most of these businesses were already failing. The things that Labour do have a large time lag. There's a huge time lag in construction. Construction is one of the places that's affected worse because it takes so long to make a building. You've got to get it approved, you've got to design it, you've got to agree all the contracts, then you've got to build it, then you've got to certify it, and only then can you do anything with it. So this environment is very, very, very time stretched. It's the time horizons that people don't think about. It's more than one parliament's worth. which is why it's so difficult to talk about with people, because people can't think in terms that are longer than one parliament's worth. I'd say it's the trigger. A lot of people aren't reinvesting or aren't upping their investment or are using it as the last straw, but really the dog is already dead, effectively. Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer are desperately sawing at the wheel, and the economy is a very large ship. I think in the short term, they can cause shocks and cause confidence loss in the finance industry. But in the real economy that doesn't exist in the finance industry, that has a lag of 3 to 5 years a lot of the time, as these companies slowly wind down in a business environment that can no longer support them. They don't go to the wall immediately. Some of it may be just that they're so reliant on capital investment that this has meant the capital investment has flown away. But it's really, it's everything. They're being beaten. They've been shot 15 times already. Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer are shooting them again. But I don't really think it makes that much difference. That the because your headline for this, you said it was slop, but it's not. Effectively, the collapse has already happened. We have already economically collapsed as a country because of the lockdowns, really, and the related financial downward spiral that the asset creation of that caused. That it's already done. You know, the economy has already been killed, but we're now watching it kind of fall down, really. It is. There's really nothing that Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, in a managerial sense, can do about it. What are they going to do? Up interest rates? Lower interest rates? Is the Bank of England going to set new policy? That can't unfail a whole bunch of medium-sized businesses. They have no levers to pull that stop these businesses from failing from their point of view.
Now, did COVID cause the problem, or was the problem pre-existing, in your view?
Well, there's a very controversial theory I have, which is COVID happened because of the problem. In that there was a lot of instability, and the managerial class went, right, let's get on board with this whole lockdown thing, because that makes us able to take a breath. Everybody pause. The business environment was already terrible in 2019. I've been through this before. If you look at the Bank of England balance sheet, it goes, it jumps in 2008, and then it jumps by the same amount between 2012 and 2014, yet no one talks about, there's the double dip recession, but no one talks about the acute financial crisis in 2014, do they?
No.
But we were in one. We were in one silently because the money was still being printed to keep the wheels turning. But the Bank of England balance sheet has increased and increased and increased and increased and increased. And we don't notice it. It goes up by more than 2008 quite often now. And it's just not commented on. It's really insane, but that is the way things are. But again, I mean, real businesses don't live in the credit environment.
On traditional metrics, the UK economy does not look like it's about to collapse. Like, for example, unemployment is historically quite low at the moment. I think it's about 1.9 million unemployed, which for a country of this size is quite low. And compared to, like, say, the Thatcher era or some other downturns we've had post 2008, we don't have mass unemployment in the UK.
Oh, we do.
Okay, go on, Tom.
They've reclassified it. Look up the economic inactivity numbers. If you look up the people who are economically inactive, only people who are actively seeking work through the job seeker system are considered unemployed. If you are not in the labour force, you're not considered unemployed. Only job seekers are considered actively unemployed. They've reclassified millions of people as economically inactive. If you're on PIP, you're not unemployed. You don't go into the unemployment figures if you're on PIP or universal credit, or if you're in any of the categories where they can class you as not unemployed or a job seeker. The economic inactivity numbers are the real numbers when you look at the economy, and they are soaring. They are higher than they have ever been. We did a stream on this called Economic Inactivity, Why Is Nobody Working? And when you look at the figures there, it is alarming the amount of people who are simply economically inactive. It's like the Blair targets. They've simply redefined people as not being unemployed. That's why the unemployment number's so low.
The official unemployment numbers are less than 2 million.
Yeah.
What is the ballpark figure if we include all these other people that you're talking about?
Economic inactivity is defined as people aged 16 to 64 not in work and not looking for work, which is around 21% of the population, including housewives and things like that. But still, if you look at the population that is effectively unemployed, it is probably close to 10%. If you look at youth unemployment, let's say under 35s of economic inactivity, it is huge. And it's the economic inactivity rate of is approximately 40% for 16 to 24 year olds in Britain. And 12.2% for 25 to 34 year olds, which is people aren't marrying and being housewives and having children. So what is this 40% of 16 to 24 year olds doing? What is this 12% of 25 to 34 year olds doing now that they're economically inactive?
Are they in education?
No.
Because they're not counted.
They're not in education. They're economically inactive. What students are generally absolved from this.
One of the odd things, though, Scrump, which is, I was listening to LBC a couple of weeks back when Rachel Reeves announced this policy where they were going to basically like force kids to work at McDonald's. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And part of me was like, I mean, I guess the part of me that admires Stalin was like, it's kind of like I can see there's a kind of an authoritarian aspect of it, which I thought I can kind of see a logic here. But another part of me was like, you know, this is getting absurd. You know, they force young people to work in Sainsbury's, Tesco's, and McDonald's. You know, at gunpoint.
Here's the actual government definition of economic inactivity. To be considered officially unemployed and not economically inactive, you have to be seeking work within the last 4 weeks or are able to start work within the next 2 weeks. If you have not been seeking work within the last 4 weeks and you're not able to start work within 2 weeks, you cannot legally be classed as unemployed.
So don't look for a job and you disappear off the stats.
Yes. If you give up for a month or you can't start work because you're a carer or you're ill or whatever, if you can't start work within 2 weeks or you've not sought work for 4 weeks, you are no longer classed as unemployed.
Right. Well, where I was going with this, though, where this gets weird is that I was listening to this LBC phone-in of lots and lots of people ringing in to LBC after Rachel Reeves announced this policy and saying, like, the government are saying, look, we're just going to make you work at these different places. But they were saying it's not as easy as that. Like, parents were ringing in, young people were ringing in, and they were saying, like, look, I've been an employee for 2 months. I can't even get a job in Costa Coffee. The competition for jobs at that level,
yes,
for McDonald's, for Costa's, for Starbucks, for a job at Sainsbury's, they can't get them anymore. It's like, you know, people are coming out of university, putting their CV in, and they can't even get like a job stack in the shelves because the competition is too high. So if what you're saying is true, and there is a large amount of people out of work, how comes we got this situation also of young people saying, like, look, I've been looking for a job, I've been applying for load, I got 100 rejection letters. What's going on?
So many people are out of work. One does affect the other. It's surplus labor. It partially is just immigration. If you add 1.3 million people to your population in a single year, that's going to have an effect on the labor market, especially with us being deindustrialized and demobilized and basically being delivery-based. The retail sector is shrinking. The manufacturing sector is shrinking. The hospitality sector is shrinking. So where are these people supposed to work? The pubs are closing. Everything's delivered now. So unless you're going to be a Deliveroo driver, where is this work supposed to come from? Show me a growth industry in Britain that is actually hiring people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, overall growth is about 0.1% or something like that. Latest growth figure. So it's
the bigger
pathetic.
Problem is, yeah, the bigger problem is that so many jobs are fake. Outside of that, you just have these sprawling email jobs, these compliance schemes, these make work schemes. I know there's a couple of more kind of economic not theory, but there's some very basic economics that affect this as well. When you look at how businesses plan, and a lot of it is the fact that all the leftists will talk about all this record turnover, but really what you're seeing, record profits, but really what you're seeing is record turnover. And if you're a business that has its turnover going up much faster than its profits, what you ignore is that really your health of a business is just your turnover, your profits divided by your turnover, your turnover divided by your profits, your ratio between the two. How much money you make from how much money you utilize. And the problem with having a high turnover and a low profit is that you're much more vulnerable to shocks. You're dealing with large amounts of money, but you're not making that much money. So all these businesses that have record profits, their expenditures are even more record. their turnover might have doubled, but their profits might have only gone up by 50%. 50% profit increase in 5 to 10 years sounds amazing until you realize that the turnover, you've had to mobilize £2 billion worth of capital rather than £1 billion to make that percentage, to make that you know, 50% increase in your profits. And I've experienced this as businesses that I've been part of, in that their turnover will be incredibly high because they're trying to attract a buyer, because businesses are bought on their turnover rather than their profits, because you're supposed to reinvest because of inflation. And that just means really that you're creating a situation of businesses that are very on the margin. They can't really pay the bills, and one shot will just end them. That's where you get so many closing with these labor policies, is that these labor policies are actually that last 1% that ticks them over. And as soon as they tick over, the business is gone.
Right. So there are a lot of supra marginal firms, we could say, on the cusp of going out of business.
Most British engineering and construction is done on extremely thin margins, 10 to 15%. And it should be closer to 50% to really be healthy as a company.
Now, you know, I've been reading a lot of Marxism recently, Scrump. You know, the old Lenin was always going on about the tendency of the falling rate of profit. Is this what we're seeing? That we're now, like, has there been this tendency of the rate of profit to keep on going down over time, and more capital needs to be spent to, you know, secure a shrinking margin of profit? That's what it sounds like you're describing.
The thing is, that's an artificial environment, though. That's under kind of mercantile managerialism. What he's describing really is the problems of managerialism, in that this people have been profitable in the past. The thing is that you got to laugh at Marxists. It's like, yes, but the ziggurats still got built in Sumeria, and they still exchanged the little clay tokens. And what I can't square about Marxism is this: you must demolish the money. You must demolish the capital. Has always moved. It's not always been mercantilism. It's not always ruled the process. You've had the rule of the elite there and the kings, but you've always had capital movement. People have made money in the past. that's the big thing. People made money fine in the past. This, you had booms, you had busts, but we still built things. You know, there's things like the Palace of Westminster still got built. People got paid to build it. So it's this ridiculous idea that the market must always fail, but history doesn't show that. And we get very autistic about economics, I think. It really is just about stability. It's not really about policy. It's about everything that allows policy to take place. It's the water of economics. It's the safety. It's the security. It's the background level of violence. It's the investment that individual people have in their own work, in their own communities. As that breaks down around it, economics is reliant on absolutely everything else. So it's this process of, well, yes, that does break down when you subject people to extremely harsh managed conditions, but also we've managed to make money in the, you know, medieval England didn't bankrupt itself because people were trading money. There's thousands of years of monetary history out there. So the Marxists are good at power, but they're really, really bad at actual the nuts and bolts of economics, because it is just like, again, so are the Austrians, to be fair. They get very autistic. It's like, look, people do just do things, but also you need a big strong man there to hit people with a stick if they don't work. And that's the problem, is that economics does come down to like grug brain. It's like, okay, what if we didn't debase our currency? What if in 5 years a pound is worth roughly the same as it was 5 years ago? And that is the way things used to be in the slower world. It's, yes, the power of capital is corrosive, but restraining money to reality rather than giving up on money seems to be the way to go. And all you can really do that with is like a big sword. And that's why there used to be the king's face on the money, because he goes, no, you idiots, this is worth this. And if you make it not worth this, I'll hit you with a big stick. No coin clipping, basically. That's how you get around failing profits in economics. It's to do with the poor management, really. It's the a lot of people in the past were a lot wiser when it came to economics, and a lot of this is just the consequences of money magic. Once money becomes abstract rather than value, it becomes, you know, an honest shake of hands. That's the big thing that people don't understand, really, is that Britain has always run on a handshake. It has always run on a handshake between people who don't all want to go bankrupt. And for a very long time, those handshakes worked. And that's why in the 20th century, when the handshake stopped working, people seemed so confused. And people thought, you can't run England on a handshake. It's like, well, we did it for hundreds of years.
So my next question, Scrump, is that, I mean, we've talked about how Britain is on the brink, or you think it's already past the brink, and we're still, you know, we still haven't been fully informed of the extent of the damage. Is every country facing the same thing, or is this unique to the mismanagement of our government?
No, it's pretty universal in the West, in what we consider the West, which is really kind of the American Empire. The American Empire is being forced to fail collectively. It's happening in America, it's happening in Germany, it's happening in France, it's happening in Spain, it's happening in Italy, it's happening in Japan, it's happening in South Korea. It's happening everywhere. Managerial economics is breaking down, partly because of birth rates being so low, and some of the unideal solutions to that our glorious leaders have come up with, which is the interchangeable economic unit, i.e. you can be replaced by Somalian, but actually you can't. So that's where reality meets theory.
It also strikes me from what you've been saying, though, that there's quite a wide, you know, in theory, if there's such an excess in the labor force, if there are so many people not working, okay, including the official unemployed and those people who are not in the labor force, as you said, there should actually be, you shouldn't see places which claim they've got a shortage of workers. But you do have places all around the country that claim that they have a shortage of workers. Like up near here, for example, there have been pubs that are saying, oh, look, we can't open on this day because we can't find any staff. So it's like, it seems like there are, not only is there an excess unemployed population, but there's not even, and in some cases, not enough jobs to go around for those people. But in other parts of the economy, we've got places claiming that they can't stay open because they can't find anyone to work there.
Well, the reason that these people are economic inactive is because largely they don't want to work, or they can't work, or they've been put in a situation where it's financially beneficial that they don't work. The idea that these people are out of work and want to work, I think, is ridiculous. They're out of work and don't want to work or can't work, or else they'd be working. It sounds self-evident, but it's true that if you look at the PIP claims, if you look at all of this stuff, a lot of people work in the grey economy, if they're immigrants or from a different ethnic background. You have a lot of incentive not to work. It is much, much, much better for you if you're in certain situations not to work in Britain. It is much more profitable. It is a huge headache sometimes for people to get part-time jobs. I used to work in kitchens as when I was doing my student stuff, you know, when I was doing engineering qualifications. And I came across people who'd be put on these work placements, but if they decided to work in the kitchen permanently, they'd lose their housing benefit and be worse off. And so that is a lot of people's situation in this country. There is genuinely a section of this country that would like to work, and on paper it's just not worth them working. They would be worse off with a job. But there's also just many people who do not want to work, are too ill to work, or have been convinced they're too ill to work. Another problem is mobility. If you've got a country pub somewhere, you can only recruit from a small area. No one's going to drive 20 miles to work minimum wage at a pub. So you've got to recruit within 20 miles of you. Well, you need to find a young person who's trustworthy and wants to work within 20 miles of you, who also can afford to run a car. And a lot of its problem is mobility. If you look at the case of the country pub, it's really obvious why they can't get people. A lot of these areas have an elderly population. They have a population that lives there, because and it's quite expensive to live there. And so who are you going to get to take a minimum wage job at a pub that you have to drive to? Who is this magical minimum wage worker in their 20s who can also afford a car?
Good point. Very good point. So you've got that happening in some local areas. But then if we go back to the kind of national picture that we were looking at before, it strikes me that there aren't actually enough jobs to go around. There is excess. But, you know, in terms of total number of available jobs, it strikes me that there is an excess population versus number of jobs. Is that not the case?
Well, yes. The third thing is there is some tension here as well, because there has been some efforts to manufacture this situation. There are large pushes towards UBI. A lot of people who are kind of managerial midwits are obsessed with UBI. It will never work. We all know why it won't work. A 10-year-old can tell you why it won't work. Yet they're obsessed with the idea that, well, most of our jobs are fake anyway, so why can't we just give people money to live and buy food and tell them to bugger off and not be a problem? That is the thinking. It's simpler to them. It is simpler to them.
And pure consumer. You are just GDP blob buy KFC. That's it.
But a lot
here's
of
some money,
just,
go and buy some KFC. Basically.
A lot of it is just inflation. A big problem is just how low take-home pay is. If you earn, I don't know, let's make up an, you know, it's Nick 30, you know, he's like this. Mm-hmm. It's Nick 30. Let's say Nick 30 actually does quite well for himself. Nick 30, before tax, makes £53,000 to £55,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But his take-home after national insurance and income tax is roughly £39,000 to £40,000. And so that's what he has to pay for everything with. And in modern England, that's not a lot of money. You're not going to be able to afford a dependent wife on that, definitely. I mean, people think £50,000 a year is a lot of money. They're stuck in the past. It's not a lot of money. It's not a lot of money anymore, and you hit the higher tax band. And if you're working 38, you know, 40, a lot of these people are working for that money 55, 60 hours a week if you're like a construction project manager. You might earn, say, £60,000 a year for that, but your take-home is still only like 43, 44. And you've got to pay for all your expenses. You've got to pay for your tickets if you're working for yourself. People forget how expensive it is to undertake meaningful work in this country. If you've got a park in London, even if you don't live in London, if you've got a park in London to work there, that's an expense. Again, running a car, having a mortgage. A lot of people can't do that anymore where they live on £55,000 to £60,000 a year, which sounds insane, but it's not. You are poor in London if you earn £60,000 to £70,000 a year, mostly because the high tax bracket is hammering those people who have massive expenses with housing. I know people who earn that much who have just been able to get starter houses in their late 30s because they've been earning, you know, £50,000, £60,000, £70,000 as the inflation's kicked in. So we forget how bad it is to employ someone. And the other side of that as well is also it doesn't cost, your take home is £39,000 a year if you're in £53,000 a year, but that's not what your employer pays to employ you. Your employer pays £70,000 to £75,000 a year. They've got to insure you, they've got to have HR around you, they've got to have all these different costs, that they've got to do your pension contributions, they've got to make up the rest of your NI. So to employ you as a worker that earns £60,000 a year could cost your employer in excess of £100,000 a year, especially if they're giving you training. Businesses have to think, can I spend an extra £100,000 a year on a skilled worker? And sometimes they will put out a tender for work, and by the time they get all the candidates sorted, they actually find the skilled person who can do it, the money's no longer in the business to hire that person, and they have to eliminate the position. I've been in that position multiple times. Luckily, I've had other job offers come along, but I've been in interview processes where they've had to apologize and say, actually, no one's getting this job because our parent company has told us they've not got as much money as they thought this year, so our hiring budget has been cut. So sorry. That's quite common. A lot of these jobs exist in perpetuity, but the company never wants to fill them because filling them will be too expensive. But they've already put the job listing out there, so you get these weird jobs that go round and round and round. There's also the managerial incentive for certain companies to advertise jobs that don't exist. They'll be paid to advertise jobs and put people through the recruitment process, but as most businesses are shrinking, they just don't hire anybody. They just get paid to do the recruitment process.
So are we going to go bust, Grump?
Well, no, because well technically we've been bust in the 30s when we decided that the gold standard couldn't meet our debts. We've gone bust about 17 times as Britain. Britain goes bust every week. We just print more money. The one I always think about is when like the pensions collapsed in about 2022. The Bank of England gave them $60 billion in a day, and we just never talked about it. We just never talked about it. Look it up. $60 billion pension rescue from the Bank of England, and they blamed Liz Truss and the cabbage economy.
All right, let me ask you a more nuanced question then. Are S&P and Moody's going to downgrade Britain's credit rating, affecting its standing in the world as a financial giant?
Mildly. I think, honestly, we might get a slight slap on the wrist. They're not going to do it massively, like they did with the whole... It'll be like the whole Liz Truss thing. They didn't. Mm-hmm. They did technically wag off their finger at us and go, naughty, naughty, you're not doing the financialization thing right. But they'll never... The thing is, that would call the bluff. They would never intentionally... That would actually make Britain collapse. That's the whole trick of managerial kind of economics, is that everything collapses and you just go, no, it doesn't. Look, we printed more money. We've got loads of money. What are you talking about? Nothing collapsed. And it's over and over and over again.
My understanding, though, and again, you can, if your understanding is different, you can explain why, is that America gets to do this endless printing thing because it's the one with the big army, right? And ultimately, the dollar is backed by just American army. Because if America just starts to default on all its debts, right, the question will be you and whose army, right? Nobody's going to invade America to recover its debts, ultimately. Well, and so it,
no one's
going
to invade Britain to recover its debts, really.
So to what I wanted to get at, though, is that the reason that America gets to it, I mean, American debt is insane. It's in the trillions and trillions at this point. They've got huge, huge debts in America.
Yeah.
In this country and in France and in Germany, to some extent, our central banks get to play this game as well. But every once in a while, you get the slap on the wrist and you get, I tell you what, if you don't get this under control, the IMF are going to come in. So we get to enjoy what they call austerity. Austerity. That was the David Cameron years. They called it austerity. Essentially, what Rachel Reeves and Starmer are doing at the moment is austerity. They're claiming it's not, but blatantly it is, because they've been told by the IMF, look, you have to get this under control. And my understanding is that where America has got basically an unlimited credit line, because that's the benefit America has for being the hegemon, Britain ultimately has a longer leash than Zimbabwe, say, right? Or one of these other, like if you're a third world country, you don't get an unlimited credit line. The IMF intervention comes faster.
You do. They managed to mess it up. They managed to even mess that up. That's like Tony Blair's frustration with Africa. It's like, look, you have an infinite credit line. How do you mess this up? That's a lot of like Europe to Africa, because they did basic. No. The 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s is all Africa being given unlimited money, and them still managed, because unlimited money can't do anything. That's the thing. It doesn't. I agree with you in that America does get a lot more financialization. It's able to print more dollars. But also we are all guilty of partaking in the money magic. It's all a wink and a nod to make our Temu lifestyles work. Ultimately, that's where you can't get wean people off it, because it is the reason you can have all your Chinese plastic crap, because America prints all that money. But also you shouldn't have all that Chinese plastic crap. It's destroying everything else around it. And that is what some of the Marxists get right about capitalism, in quotes, is that just infinite expansion, just infinite widget making isn't a solution. There's no metaphysic there. The solution really is something that communists wouldn't want, is to have a nation that has a theology about what it's doing economically, like a political theology about what it's doing economically. And that is completely alien to anyone who's a libertarian, that we should have as a nation a vision of what we do, and a vision of what our production is for and what it is all for. And that is the answer there. But we all participate. We are all guilty of eating from the inflationary money magic trough. We all take out car loans. You know, most people will use things like Zillow. PayPal by default offers you interest-free 3 payment plans for everything now. We all participate in the money magic. And that's why America, when they say they support Europe and Britain economically, are technically correct in that they help keep us on like the managerial money drugs, but it's not really supporting us. It's just further financialization. The Americans do shoulder a lot of the burden of inflationism in other countries from their point of view, but also they exploit their territories. But they exploit their territories because, again, from their point of view, they're going under as well. They get to do all the fun, have all the money magic, and print all the money and be trillions and trillions in debt. But they're also just about staying above water. So it's, we can blame America for it, but really it is to do with the way that we've been structured to interact with money. We don't think about money in the way that people did in the past. It's magic to us. We have become completely disconnected from economic reality. And when you try and get people to interact with economic reality, it makes them panic because they think about how in debt they are, really.
So if our relationship with money is magic, what's the point of trying to balance the books?
Well, they don't.
And what's the point of playing this game that the government does every once in a while? Oh, look, our debt is too big. We have to get it under control. Who cares?
It's to actually stop the wheelbarrow spread of money. It's not to do with spending. Don't try and balance the books because we're in debt. They're trying to balance the books because the spending of the money causes massive amounts of inflation. The austerity is to burn the inflation. It's to intentionally... You becoming poorer is a feature, not a bug, because you have to become poorer or else the inflation rates will be so high that you will become even more visibly poorer. It's about which way you hide the poverty. You move into a slightly lower money economy and you make people suffer that way and you pretend that they're balancing the books, but they're not actually balancing the books. They're burning the inflation they've already caused. It's a reverse process. You print the money, then you spend it. And once you've spent it, you can't counteract the effects of spending it. You can't, you know, go ahead, call the IMF. They can't uninflate you. It's that kind of thing. It's the post hoc. It's people don't understand that the shocks we see now are from economic policies done 5, 10, 15, 25 years ago. And that to actually reckon with them is reckoning with the last quarter century of our economic history, not just the last parliamentary term.
Just before we wrap up, one of the things I was reading recently, again, from a leftist who was claiming that the government, mainly the Tory government, has to be said, but also sometimes Labour, as an act of class warfare, deliberately engineer excess unemployment in order to, one, go on various wars against scroungers, benefits, cheats. You know, in the 90s, it was single mothers. Do you remember that whole thing?
I remember that, yes.
Right? And they always do that in times of high unemployment. And another is to crush wages and disadvantage labor against capital, and that this is actually a deliberate policy, and that this can explain certain things that they've done recently as well.
Some people do that. I honestly think that most of this comes from people who have, if you can believe it, good intentions. And that they truly believe that they are trying to balance the labor market, in quotes. But to balance the labor market in a way that advantages them as the managerial class, they have to do that. They have to keep the price of labor at pretty much nil. They have to have infinite people to fill infinite positions. Or from their point of view, the entire managerial machine locks up. As soon as you have full employment, that's terrible. But as soon as you have any unemployment, that's also terrible. It's this weird formula where you have one less job than everybody wants, and if you get one more job than there are people, then the whole thing falls down. And they're really just trying to create this situation where there's this perfect match between labor supply and labor demand. But the metrics they use to gauge and predict labor demand are hopelessly optimistic in many cases. They just don't have a grip on reality. And so their lack of grip on reality causes them to create these acute crises. Now, some people do know how to create these acute crises for their own benefit deliberately. But I don't think as a class, they do try and deliberately create these crises in an acute sense. I actually think it disadvantages them. If they could not do it, I think in many cases they wouldn't. Most people assume malice when it comes to this, but it is a mix of both. If these people could deliver a functioning economy through managerialism that kept us all happy, they would. If they could do it, they would. The answer is that these people can't do it. There is no way to balance the books. There is no way to create full employment. There is no way to square the economic circle. And it's like a finger trap. Everything you do to try and square the economic circle that doesn't work in like old world terms, that isn't just, I am a powerful man and I will create stable conditions that I think are to my advantage. As soon as you start trying to micromanage everything, like you're Karen from accounts, that's when the whole thing falls down. Because you're not competent enough to manage an economy, stupid. And that's what the Austrians talk about. But also they just don't like the idea that economics is completely underpinned by everything else. And that you need effectively what Europe has had for hundreds of years, which is a dictatorship from a competent elite that colludes together to make sure that things function. Because everyone thinks we're against like elite collusion and things like that. But I'm very for elite collusion. I'm for elites colluding together to make things better and work better. And their idea of how to make things better and how to work better only has this kind of pound shot middle management imagination to it. And a lot of the ill effects we see that we put up to conspiracy, there are people who exploit them and there are people that know they're coming. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is the fact that managerialism just can't deliver what it promises. It's hopelessly optimistic. Yeah. And these people are, in many cases, incredibly weak and incompetent.
One of the things I've looked at, and again, I'm just thinking outside the box a little bit, Scrum, we were talking, you know, employment. There was pretty much close to full employment in the 60s and 70s and the so-called post-war consensus, okay? Now, lots of those jobs you could argue were fake. Lots of those jobs you could argue were not profitable. Some of them were of the magnitude of Mr. Kane says, go and dig a ditch and fill it back in again type stuff. But that world kind of was Trumpdom. It was fake, but people were happy. It didn't make money, didn't make a lot of money, right? And it, you know, you could argue it led to structural problems down the line, but it was kind of an artificial by the rules of the market, but it was held, something was held in place there for a period of 20 or 30 years. And people felt they had a kind of purpose in the system towards something, even if nobody was buying the stuff they were making, or even if those industries, you know, in a long enough time horizon were quote unquote failing, they existed and it was kept going for a period of 20 or 30 years. You could argue similar things could be seen in FDR's America as well, New Deal America, where they created these like huge works programs, which work for a while. They work for a while, right? And then we got Thatcher and Reagan and mass unemployment and the financialized world. At the moment, people are looking across to China, they're looking across to other systems, and they're thinking, well, maybe something about that worked. Even if it only works for 20 or 30 years, you could just do it again for a while, and it would give people a sense of meaning and purpose, even if, in reality, it's a kind of Potemkin village. You're just kind of running it as the Matrix. What do you think about that idea?
We're still in the Potemkin village. The problem is you can't maintain the Potemkin village. The idea that Thatcher and Reagan were a break from the post-war consensus, I believe, is extremely flawed. Reagan is the father of Social Security. He's the father of MLK Day as a national holiday in America. He was very continuation with the post-war consensus. What happened is that world failed. The vision of the interchangeable economic unit where we're all supplied with jobs and we're all happy and we're all decent, we're all liberal, it just didn't work. You got the 70s, you got malaise, you got Carter, you ended up in the 70s in Britain, and really just everyone ran out of confidence. And a lot of the financialization is just them shuffling around who bears the inflatory and debt burden. It was, well, central banks won't print money anymore, merchant banks will. We'll privatize the money printing. But really, it was the same entities and the same people. There is complete continuation between the two. It's what we always talk about, which is decline. We still live in a 60s vision of Britain. It has just declined horribly since then. And to try and fill in the labor market gaps and the employment, they genuinely did turn to immigration. That was their answer. That in their heads, that made sense. And it was terrible. But that was their answer to try and keep that world going. They thought, well, Trumpton needs cheap workers. We can't get any more cheap workers. The economy is failing. No one can clean the tables in Trumpton. We'll get someone in Nigeria to clean the tables in Trumpton. And oh, no, it's not Trumpton anymore. Oh, well, that didn't work.
Right.
I think it is this degrading vision. There's not these hard dividing lines. There's this continuous process of lesser men managing the civilization built by greater men. And no matter how comfortable they try and make it, it doesn't work. I know it's a cop-out and people, oh, you always say that. But really, it's just that the equality of our elites isn't good enough to bring us profitability. These people don't know how to make money. And if Britain is a giant business, it shouldn't be run by people who don't know how to make money. I love all the leftists who are like, the government just wants to make money out of you. I was like, well, I'd love it if it did. If the government was trying to make money out of me, at least someone would be making money. But it seems the government's very good at losing money out of people. It doesn't make money out of people at all. And so I think their vision of the world is very flawed. There's this obsession in leftist theory about money and capitalization. Whereas if you understand power, you understand that power, raw power, real power, actually kind of laughs at money. It uses money. The money power has become very strong. But money is backed by sovereignty. You know, money is, it's not that America controls the dollar. It's actually that it can vaporize you. And that's where the power of the dollar comes from. But people get that. I think Marxists get that equation backwards. And really, it's if you want to get as postmodern as possible, you know, money is a human construct. We can do what we want with it. In fact, the failure of money is the failure of our imaginations. It's the failure of us to undertake productive work properly and not get in our own way. Money is a big band-aid over the fact that you get maverick individuals who do great things that other people around them can't do. And if you run out of those people, if you're no longer a civilization that produces those people, it doesn't matter what your economic policy is. It doesn't matter what people do as a mass. It doesn't really matter what ideology you believe or what parameters you set for how your economy operates. You're not going to be glorious as golden eras are. There's this great sense of Britain during its expanse, you know, through its many kind of golden eras, that there's this great sense of just confidence that it just kind of happened. But that's the way things are. A lot of people do a lot of really cool things and people go, wow, that's really cool. And it's difficult to describe because it's almost like a metaphysical event. There's this metaphysic there of people who are able to just move things, and to people around them it's magic. And those people go away because the country's not as safe and secure as it was anymore, or it's just all the different factors we take for granted as civilizing forces. But economic activity only takes place productively within a civilization. And if the civilizational factors start to break down, there's no economic policy you can do to fix that. You need to fix the things that economics is dependent on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, it all makes sense to me. So what about putting everybody on UBI and sticking them in the Matrix VAT, Scrump? Just like give up, play video games all day. Just have the neat economy where...
In
just...
certain ways, it will be better than this. Maybe we just need to do that to show people why they don't do it. But I honestly think it would be better than all these people working these fake jobs. Like, I think we should turn the internet off on Sundays, you know? Give people a day off. Replace it with, like, a little map that shows where your local pub is. And just put have a day off on people's phones. That would be a lot like a weird paternal managed society would be better than this.
Right.
It's okay, I just wish people would try.
Big Brother says no internet on Sundays. Your phone automatically turns off. You have no, the internet is shut down on Sundays, so you must go to the pub. Something
you
like
have
that.
You can do what you want, but it removes all the voices, you know. Just replace all social media with a little note on a Sunday that says, you do realize that social media is not real, right? You do realize the internet isn't real life. You have to know that, right? it would do us an immense amount of psychic good, I think.
Right.
I'm not objecting to Big Brother. I just think our Big Brother's terrible. They're not a very competent Big Brother. If you're going to have paternalistic instincts, you should at least be somewhat able to be paternal.
To come back to the real world as we started, is there anything that can kickstart the British economy from here?
Yes, stability. What you do is you have to get rid of... I've got a few notes here. I'll go through them very briefly about the fact that what you've got is just massive time horizons, massive price increases. You're just not able to plan economically. If you were able to say, right, we are halting the trading... This is what Russia did, but this is what Russia did. We are halting the trading and the speculation of the pound. We are no longer listening to the economic ratings agencies. We are no longer interfacing properly with international finance. We are admitting that money is only real when it interfaces with the real economy. And we're creating, like, actually almost like a Soviet five-year plan would be the only thing you could do. But you'd have to shut down financialization. You'd have to turn around, again, like Putin had to with the whole Ukraine war thing, to the international finance people and go, no speculating. Our currency is worth this. It'll be worth this in 5 years. Here's your planning environment. Submit your business proposals. Like, it would almost be like starting from scratch, and it would cause a huge amount of things to fail. But the admittance that the UK economy isn't real would be, from many people's point of view, a disaster, but it's the only thing that you can do where you can start to get things moving again, is you have to admit that what's currently there isn't reality, because eventually people are just going to notice it's not reality, or it's just going to run into, as it always does, reality-based conditions, which is why all these, despite billions of billions being pumped into the construction industry, all these construction industries, all these construction firms are still failing.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't all that just be achieved by the central bank saying, like, look, we're just putting a 5-year freeze on money printing, so the amount of pounds is fixed for the next 5 years?
Well, no, because then all the international finance people go, ha-ha, we can attack your currency because our finance magic says that'll make your economy crash. So we'll make it a self-fulfilling prophecy and we'll debase your currency and make it crash so it makes our prophecy come true.
Take the pound off the exchange. Take the floating pound away for five years.
You'd have to do both, though. You'd have to go no money printing, no currency speculation as a starting point, I would say. But also you'd need to go out into you'd actually need to physically go out into the country and find people who are running successful businesses and ask them to take over areas of the economy wholesale. Actually give over bits of Britain to people like, I don't even fantasize about this, but not doing it in like a managerial sense, doing it in like a mafia sense. Like, okay, we are the money managers of Britain. We are Britain's small board. We're going to go out and find out people.
Give it to Lord Sugar. Alan Sugar. We're going to
find people who can actually make money, but not only make money, but make products that are good. Because really, if you find people who run a business well, most of them aren't money obsessed. You find people who are weirdly obsessed with what they actually do to the point that they will lose money doing it, which is a lot of what a lot of passionate business people in Britain actually do. I've witnessed people do this. It's always a shame to watch someone who's actually passionate about what they do not be able to make money doing it, even though they do a good job of it. That's what Britain's like, though. You just need to find those people, find those weirdos who can't help but work in a certain area. You know, all you need is like, I don't know, like 50 Fred Dibners. Like, you get your Fred Dibner of the packaging industry. You get your Fred Dibner of the car industry. Mm-hmm. And that's what Britain did in the 19th century. They got all these weirdos who are obsessed with it. And you know, them to do stuff for them.
This sounds like fantasy stuff, but Farage has talked about doing this. Farage has talked about stacking the cabinet with business people.
But the cabinet can't do anything. The cabinet is like the autopilot and the dog. Mm-hmm. The Bank of England's there to stop the cabinet doing anything. The cabinet's there to stop the Bank of England doing anything. It's the nothing ever happens. You'd have to completely unless like Farage can declare himself king and actually give these people baronages that are real, actually start passing off bits of land to them to build industrial zones in. But it's not going to happen because the cabinet doesn't control Britain. International finance does.
Right. It's been fascinating, Scrump. It's been fascinating. My mind is wandering to think about I'm just thinking about like, you know that show Dragon's Den? They're like the Dragon's Den, running a section of the British economy. That's essentially what you're talking about, really, isn't it?
What if some mad industrialist seized power and started appointing his friends? It's like, well, it depends on his industrious. It depends how good his friends are. That is British history, though. Some mad person comes in with a mad idea and does mad things for a while, and people go, oh, wow, that's really cool. It's hard to explain in less general terms than that, but this is just effect where you get this upward spiral of eccentric productivity that transcends the monetary incentive. You need people who want to reach for greatness, really, and that's very difficult to find.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Where can people find you, Scrump?
Oh, yes. We've done the book off already, but if you can find me on YouTube at Scrump Monkey on YouTube. You can find me on Twitter at Nomos Events. We've not done one of those in a while, but hopefully at some point. God, we've been far too busy, though. We also wrote a book, as we did the book off earlier. That's over at Whifflings Publishing, who also put out all the Major General Hilton stuff, which I do have somewhere in the other room. All very good stuff there, but mostly, we've also got Telegram, but, you know, if you want to keep in contact that way. We mostly just do the occasional YouTube stream, but we mostly recommend people buy the book these days, because it's our most, I think, cohesive statement about what we actually believe. Because a lot of people struggle to think, what are you guys actually about? So we wrote a whole book.
Great, yeah, I recommend, I always watch your streams, so check them out, obviously, by a course, the Academic Agency, and I'll catch you next time. And warning, Scrump is just going to kick us out, right? We're just going to be hard kicked out, so bye-bye.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.